He gripped her hand, not hard enough to hurt, but enough to stop her retreat.
"You understand the risks, and yet you're still helping me," he said. "Why?"
"It's the right thing."
"My father's laws say otherwise."
Her face heated. "I don't know what you want me to say."
His hands were cool as he brushed her cheeks, his calluses scraping gently.
"I just want to thank you,"
he murmured, leaning in,
"for seeing me and not running."
"I..."
She was burning up from the inside out, and she pulled back, hard enough that he let go. Amethy was right, even if she was vicious. There were plenty of beautiful women here, and anything more than a flirtation would end poorly.
He was crown prince, and she was nobody.
She gestured to the goblet.
"If it's not too much trouble, Your Highness."
He cringed at the title.
"Send word about how this one works for you."
She didn't dare a by your leave or farewell or anything that would keep her in that room a moment longer. And he didn't try to stop her as she walked out and shut the door behind her. She leaned against the stone wall of the narrow landing, a hand on her thundering heart. It was the smart thing to do, the right thing to do. She had survived this long, and would only survive the road ahead if she continued to be unnoticed, reliable, quiet. But she didn't want to be unnoticed. Not with him. Not forever. He made her want to laugh and sing and shake the world with her voice. The door swung open, and she found him standing in the doorway, solemn and wary. Maybe there could be no future, no hope of anything more. But just looking at him standing there, in this moment, she wanted to be selfish and stupid and wild. It could all go to hell tomorrow, but she had to know what it was like, just for a little while, to belong to someone, to be wanted and cherished. He did not move, didn't do anything but stare, seeing her exactly how she saw him. As she grabbed the lapels of his tunic, pulled his face down to hers, and kissed him fiercely. Kaol had barely been able to concentrate for the past few days, thanks to the meeting he was moments away from having. It had taken longer than he had anticipated before Ren and Murtaugh were finally ready to meet him, their first encounter since that night in the slums. Kaol had to wait for his next night off. Adian had to find a secure location, and then they had to coordinate with the two lords from Terrasen. He and the general had left the castle separately, and Kaol had hated himself when he lied to his men about where he was going. Hated that they wished him fun. Hated that they trusted him, the man who was meeting with their mortal enemies. Kaol shoved those thoughts aside as he approached the dim alley a few blocks from the decrepit boarding house where they were to meet. Under his heavy hooded cloak, he was armed more heavily than he usually bothered. Every breath he took felt too shallow. A two-note whistle sounded down the alley, and he echoed it. Adian stalked through the low-lying mist coming off the aviary, his face concealed in the cowl of his own cloak. He wasn't wearing the Sword of Orinth. Instead, an assortment of blades and fighting knives were strapped to the general. A man able to walk into hell itself and come out grinning.
"Where are the others?"
Kaol said softly. The slums were quiet tonight, too quiet for his liking. Dressed as he was, few would dare approach him. But the walk through the crooked and dark streets had been harrowing. Such poverty and despair, and desperation. It made people dangerous, willing to risk anything to scratch out another day of living. Adian leaned against the crumbling brick wall behind them. "Don't get your undergarments in a twist. They'll be here soon."
I've waited long enough for this information.
What's the rush? Adian drawled, scanning the alley.
I'm leaving Rifthold in a few weeks to return to NEO.
Adian didn't look directly at him, but he could feel the general staring at him from beneath his dark hood. So get out of it. Tell them you're busy.
I made a promise, Kaol said. I've already bargained for time, but I want to have done something for the prince before I leave.
The general turned to him then. I'd heard you were estranged from your father. Why the sudden change? It would have been easier to lie, but Kaol said,
My father is a powerful man. He has the ear of many influential members at court and is on the king's council.
Adian let out a low laugh.
I've butted heads with him in more than a few war councils.
That Kaol would have paid good money to see. But he wasn't smiling as he said,
It was the only way I could get her sent to Wendwin.
He quickly explained the bargain he'd made, and when he was finished, Adian loosed a long breath.
Damn,
the general said,
then shook his head. I didn't think that kind of honor still existed in Otterlin.
He supposed it was a compliment, and a high one coming from Adian.
And what of your father?
Kaol said, if only to shift conversation away from the hole in his chest.
I know your mother was kin to her, but what of your father's line?
My mother never admitted who my father was, even when she was wasting away on her sickbed, Adian said flatly. I don't know if it was from shame, or because she couldn't even remember, or to protect me somehow. Once I was brought over here, I didn't really care. But I'd rather have no father than your father.
Kaol chuckled, and might have asked another question, had boots not scraped on stone at the other end of the alley, followed by a rasping breath.
That fast, Adian had palmed two fighting knives, and Kaol drew his own sword. A bland, nondescript blade he'd swiped from the barracks, as a man staggered into view. He had an arm wrapped around his middle, the other bracing himself against the brick wall of an abandoned building. Adian was instantly moving, knives sheathed again. It wasn't until Kaol heard him say,
Ren,
that he also hurried toward the young man. In the moonlight, the blood on Ren's tunic was a shining deep stain.
Where is Murtagh?
Adian demanded, sliding an arm under Ren's shoulders.
Safe,
Ren panted, his face deathly pale. Kaol scanned either end of the alley.
We were followed, so we tried losing them.
He heard, more than saw, Ren's wince.
They cornered me.
How many?
Adian said softly, though Kaol could almost feel the violence simmering off the general.
Eight,
Ren said, and hissed in pain.
Killed two, then got free. They're following me.
Leaving six. If they were unharmed, they were probably close behind. Kaol examined the stones beyond Ren. The wound to his abdomen couldn't be deep, if he'd managed to keep the blood flow from leaving a trail. But it still had to be agonizing, potentially fatal, if it had pierced the wrong spot. Adian went rigid, hearing something that Kaol couldn't. He quietly, gently, passed the sagging Ren into Kaol's arms.
There are three barrels 10 paces away,
the general said with lethal calm as he faced the alley entrance.
Hide behind them and keep your mouths shut.
That was all Kaol needed to hear as he took Ren's weight and hauled him to the large barrels, then eased him onto the ground. Ren stifled a groan of pain, but kept still. There was a small crack between two of the barrels where Kaol could see the alley, and the six men who stalked into it almost shoulder to shoulder. He couldn't make out much more than dark tunics and cloaks. The men paused when they beheld Adian standing before them, still hooded. The general drew his fighting knives and purred.
None of you are leaving this alley alive.
They didn't. Kaol marveled at Adian's skill, the speed and swiftness and utter confidence that made it like watching a brutal, unforgiving dance. It was over before it really started. The six assailants seemed at ease with weapons, but against a man with fey blood surging in his veins, they were useless. No wonder Adian had risen to such high ranking so quickly. He'd never seen another man fight like that. Only Selena had come close. He couldn't tell which one of them would win if they were ever matched against each other. But together, Kaol's heart went cold at the thought. Six men dead in a matter of moments. Six. Adian wasn't smiling as he came back over to Kaol and dropped a scrap of fabric on the ground before them. Even Ren, panting through clenched teeth, looked. It was a black, heavy material, and emblazoned on it in dark thread, nearly invisible save for the glint of moonlight, was a wyvern. The royal sigil.
I don't know these men,
Kaol said, more to himself than to protest his innocence.
I've never seen that uniform.
From the sound of it, Adian said, that rage still simmering in his voice, as he cocked his head toward noises that Kaol could not hear with his human ears.
There are more of them out there, and they're combing the slums door to door for Ren. We need a place to hide.
Ren held on to consciousness long enough to say,
I know where.
Chapter 30 Kaol held his breath for the entire walk as he and Adian gripped the half-conscious Ren between them, the three of them swaying and staggering, looking for all the world like drunkards out for a night of thrills in the slums. The streets were still teeming despite the hour, and one of the women they passed slouched over and gripped Adian's tunic, spewing a slur of sultry words. But the general used a gentle hand to disengage her and said,
I don't pay for what I can get for free.
Somehow it felt like a lie, since Kaol hadn't seen or heard of Adian sharing anyone's bed all these weeks. But perhaps knowing that Aelin was alive changed his priorities. They reached the opium den Ren had named in between spurts of unconsciousness, just as the shouts of soldiers storming into boarding houses, inns, and taverns echoed from down the street. Kaol didn't wait to see who they were and shoved through the carved wooden door. The reek of unwashed bodies, waste, and sweet smoke clotted in Kaol's nostrils. Even Adian coughed and gave Ren, who was almost a dead weight in their arms, a disapproving stare. But the aging madam swept forward to greet them, her long tunic and overrobe flowing on some phantom wind, and ushered them down the wood-paneled hallway, her feet soft on the worn, colorful rugs. She began prattling off prices and the night specials, but Kaol took one look in her green, cunning eyes and knew she was familiar with Ren, someone who had probably built herself her own empire here in Rifthold. She set them up in a veiled-off alcove littered with worn silk cushions that stank of sweet smoke and sweat, and after she lifted her brows at Kaol, he handed over 3 gold pieces. Ren groaned from where he was sprawled on the cushions between Adian and Kaol, but before Kaol could so much as say a word, the madam returned with a bundle in her arms.
They are next door, she said,
her accent lovely and strange.
Hurry.
She'd brought a tunic. Adian made quick work of stripping Ren, whose face was deathly pale, lips bloodless. The general swore as they beheld the wound, a slice low in his belly.
Any deeper in his damn intestines would be hanging out, Adian said.
He took a strip of clean fabric from the madam and wrapped it around the young lord's muscled abdomen. There were scars all over Ren already. If he survived, this probably would not be the worst of them. The madam knelt before Kaol and opened the box in her hands. Three pipes now lay on the low-lying table before them.
You need to play the part, she breathed, glancing over her shoulder through the thick black veil,
no doubt calculating how much time they had left. Kaol didn't even try to object as she used rouge to redden the skin around his eyes, applied some paste and powder to leach the color from his face, shook free a few buttons on his tunic, and mussed his hair.
Lay back, limp and loose, and keep the pipe in your hand. Smoke it if you need to take the edge off.
That was all she told him before she got to work on Adian, who had finished stuffing Ren into his clean clothes. In moments, the three of them were reclined on the reeking cushions, and the madam had bustled off with Ren's bloody tunic. The lord's breathing was labored and uneven, and Kaol fought the shaking in his own hands as the front door banged open. The soft feet of the madam hurried past to greet the men. Though Kaol strained to hear, Adian seemed to be listening without a problem.
Five of you, then?
The madam chirped loudly enough for them to hear.
We're looking for a fugitive, was the growled response. Clear out of the way.
Surely you would like to rest. We have private rooms for groups, and you are all such big men.
Each word was purred, a sensual feast.
It is extra for bringing in swords and daggers. A liability, you see, when the drug takes you—
Woman, enough!
The man barked. Fabric ripped as each veiled alcove was inspected. Kaol's heart thundered, but he kept his body limp, even as he itched to reach for his blade.
Then I shall leave you to your work,
she said demurely. Between them, Ren was so dazed that he truly could have been drugged out of his mind. Kaol just hoped his own performance was convincing as the curtain ripped back.
Is that the wine?
Adian slurred, squinting at the men, his face wan and his lips set in a loose grin. He was hardly recognizable.
We've been waiting 20 minutes, you know.
Kaol smiled blearily up at the six men peering into the room. All in those dark uniforms. All unfamiliar. Who the hell were they? Why had Ren been targeted?
Wine,
Adian snapped. A spoiled son of a merchant, perhaps.
Now.
The men just swore at them and continued on. 5 minutes later, they were gone. The den must have been a meeting point, because Murtaugh found them there an hour later. The madam had brought them to her private office, and they'd been forced to pin Ren to the worn couch as she, with surprising adeptness, disinfected, stitched, and bound up his nasty wound. He would survive, she said, but the blood loss and injury would keep him incapacitated for a while. Murtaugh paced the entire time, until Ren collapsed into a deep sleep, courtesy of some tonic the woman made him choke down. Kaol and Adian sat at the small table crammed in amongst the crates upon crates of opium stacked against the walls. He didn't want to know what was in the tonic Ren had ingested. Adian was watching the locked door, head cocked as if listening to the sounds of the den, as he said to Murtaugh,
Why were you being followed? And who were those men?
The old man kept pacing.
I don't know, but they knew where Ren and I would be. Ren has a network of informants throughout the city, and one of them could have betrayed us.
Adian's attention remained on the door, a hand on one of his fighting knives.
They wore uniforms with the royal sigil. Even the captain didn't recognize them. You need to lay low for a while.
Murtaugh's silence was too heavy. Kaol asked quietly,
Where do we bring him when he can be moved?
Murtaugh paused his pacing, his eyes full of grief.
There is no place. We have no home.
Adian looked sharply at him.
Where in the hell have you been staying all this time? Here and there, squatting in abandoned buildings. When we are able to take work, we stay in boarding houses. But these days...
They would not have access to the Alsbrook coffers, Kaol realized. Not if they had been in hiding for so many years.
But to be homeless...
Adian's face was a mask of disinterest.
And you have no place in Rifthold safe enough to hold him, to see his mending.
Not a question, but Murtagh nodded all the same. Adian examined Wren, sprawled on the dark sofa against the far wall. His throat bobbed once, but then he said,
Tell the captain your theory about magic.
In the long hours that passed, as Wren regained his strength enough to be moved, Murtagh explained everything he knew. His entire story came out, the old man almost whispering at times, of the horrors they'd fled, and how Wren had gotten each and every scar. Kaol understood why the young man had been so close-lipped until now. Secrecy had kept them alive. Altogether, Murtagh and Wren had learned the various waves the day magic had vanished formed a rough triangle across the continent. The first line went from Rifthold to the Frozen Wastes. The second went down from the Frozen Wastes to the edge of the deserted peninsula. The third line went from there back to Rifthold. A spell, they believed, had been the cause of it. Standing around the map Adian had produced, the general traced a finger over the lines again and again, as if sorting out a battle strategy.
A spell sent from specific points, like a beacon.
Kaol thumped his knuckles on the table.
Is there some way of undoing it?
Murtagh sighed.
Our work was interrupted by the disturbance with Archer, and our sources vanished from the city for fear of their lives. But there has to be a way.
So where do we start looking? Adian asked.
There's no chance in hell the king would leave clues lying around.
Murtagh nodded.
We need eyewitnesses to confirm what we suspect. But the places we think the spell originated are occupied by the king's forces. We've been waiting for an inn.
Adian gave him a lazy grin. No wonder you kept telling Wren to be nice to me. As if in response, Wren groaned, struggling to rise to consciousness. Had the young lord ever felt safe or at peace at any point in the past 10 years? It would explain that anger. The reckless anger that coursed through all the young, shattered hearts of Terrasen, including Selena's. Kaol said,
There is an apartment hidden in a warehouse in the slums. It's secure and has all the amenities you need. You're welcome to stay there for however long you require.
He felt Adian watching him carefully. But Murtagh frowned.
However generous, I cannot accept the offer to stay in your house.
It's not my house, Kaol said. And believe me, the owner won't mind one bit.
Chapter 31 Eat it, Manon said, holding out the raw leg of mutton to Abraxos. The day was bright, but the wind off the snowy peaks of the Fangs still carried a brutal chill. They'd been going outside the mountain for little spurts to stretch his legs, using the back door that opened onto a narrow road leading into the mountains. She'd guided him by the giant chain, as if it would do anything to stop him from taking off, up a sharp incline, and then onto the meadow atop a plateau.
Eat it, she said, shaking the freezing meat at Abraxos, who was now lying on his belly in the meadow, huffing at the first grasses and flowers to poke through the melting ice.
It's your reward, she said through her teeth.
You earned it.
Abraxos sniffed at a cluster of purple flowers, then flicked his eyes to her.
No meat, he seemed to say.
It's good for you, she said.
And he went right back to sniffing the violets or whatever they were. If a plant wasn't good for poisoning or healing or keeping her alive if she were starving, she'd never bothered to learn its name. Especially not wildflowers. She tossed the leg right in front of his massive mouth and tucked her hands into the folds of her red cloak. He snuffed at it, his new iron teeth glinting in the radiant light. Then stretched out on one massive claw-tipped wing and shoved it aside. Manon rubbed her eyes. Is it not fresh enough? He moved to sniff some white and yellow flowers. A nightmare. This was a nightmare. You can't really like flowers. Again, those dark eyes shifted to her. Blinked once. I most certainly do, he seemed to say. She splayed her arms. You never even smelled a flower until yesterday. What's wrong with the meat now? He needed to eat tons and tons of meat to put on the muscle he was lacking. When he went back to sniffing the flowers rather delicately, the insufferable, useless worm, she stalked to the leg of mutton and hauled it up. If you won't eat it, she snarled at him, hoisting it up with both her hands to her mouth and popping her iron teeth down. Then I will. Abraxos watched her with those bemused dark eyes as she bit into the icy, raw meat and spat it everywhere. What in the mother's dark shadow? She sniffed at the meat. It wasn't rancid, but like the men here, it tasted off. The sheep were raised inside the mountain, so maybe it was something in the water. As soon as she got back, she'd give the 13 the order not to touch the men. Not until she knew what in hell was making them taste and smell that way. Regardless, Abraxos had to eat, because he had to get strong, so she could be wing leader. So she could see the look on Iskra's face when she ripped her apart at the war games. And if this was the only way to get the worm to eat... Fine, she said, chucking the leg away. You want fresh meat? She scanned the mountains towering around them, eyeing the gray stones. Then we're going to have to hunt. You smell like shit and blood. Her grandmother didn't turn from her desk, and Manon didn't flinch at the insult. She was covered in both, actually. It was thanks to Abraxos, the flower-loving worm, who had just watched while she scaled one of the nearby cliffs and brought down a braying mountain goat for him. Brought down was a more elegant phrase than what had actually happened. She half froze to death as she waited for some goats to pass on their treacherous climb. And then, when she'd finally ambushed one, she'd not only rolled in its dung as she'd grappled with it, but it had also dumped a fresh load on her, right before it went tumbling out of her arms and broke its skull on the rocks below. It had nearly taken her with it, but she'd managed to grab onto a dead root. Abraxos was still lying on his belly, sniffing the wildflowers, when she returned with the dead goat in her arms, its blood now iced on her cloak and tunic. He'd devoured the goat in two bites, then gone back to enjoying the wildflowers. At least he'd eaten. Getting him back to the Northern Fang, however, was a trial in itself. He hadn't hurt her, hadn't fled, but he'd pulled on the chains, shaking his head again and again as they neared the cavernous back door, where the sounds of the wyverns and men reached them. But he'd gone in, though he'd snapped and growled at the handlers who rushed out to retrieve him. For some reason, she hadn't been able to stop thinking about his reluctance, the way he'd looked at her with a mute plea. She didn't pity him, because she pitied nothing. But she couldn't stop thinking about it. You summoned me, said Manon, head high. I did not want to keep you waiting. You are keeping me waiting, Manon. The witch turned, eyes full of death and promises of endless pain. It has been weeks now, and you are not airborne with your 13.
The Yellowlegs have been flying as a host for 3 days.
3 days, Manon.
And you're coddling your beast.
Manon didn't show one flicker of feeling. Apologizing would make it worse, as would excuses.
Give me orders, and they will be done.
I want you airborne by tomorrow evening. Don't bother coming back if you aren't.
I hate you, Manon panted through her iron teeth, as she and Abraxos finished their grueling trek to the top of the mountain peak. It had taken half a day to get here, and if this didn't work, it would take until evening to get back to the Omega, to pack her belongings. Abraxos was curled up like a cat on the narrow stretch of flat rock atop the mountain.
Willful, lazy worm.
He didn't even blink at her. Take the eastern side, the overseer had said, as he'd helped her saddle up and set out from the back door of the northern fang before dawn. They used this peak to train the hatchling wyverns and reluctant flyers. The eastern side, Manon saw, as she peered over the lip she'd just climbed, was a smooth incline after a 20-foot drop. Abraxos could take a running start off the edge, try to glide, and if he fell, well, it would only be 20 feet, and then wind-smooth rock to slide down for a ways. Slim possibility for death. No, death lay on the western side. Frowning at Abraxos, who was licking his new iron claws, Manon crossed the plateau and, despite herself, winced at the blistering wind that shot up. To the west was an endless plunge through nothing, until the spiked, unforgiving rocks below. It would take a crew of men to scrape off her remains. Eastern side it was. She checked her tight braid and flicked her clear inner lid into place. Let's go. Abraxos lifted his massive head as if to say, "We just got here." She pointed to the eastern edge. Flying. Now. He huffed, curling his back to her, the leather saddle gleaming.
Oh, I don't think so, she snapped,
stalking around to get in his face. She pointed to the edge again. We're flying, you rutting coward. He tucked his head toward his belly, his tail wrapping around him. He was pretending he couldn't hear her. She knew it might cost her life, but she gripped his nostrils, hard enough to make his eyes fly open. Your wings are functional. The humans said they were. So you can fly, and you are going to fly because I say so. I've been fetching your useless carcass mountain goats by the herd, and if you humiliate me, I'll use your hide for a new leather coat. She rustled her torn and stained crimson cloak. This is ruined thanks to your goats. He shifted his head away, and she let go, because it was either let go or be tossed into the air. He set down his head and closed his eyes. This was punishment somehow. For what, she didn't know. Perhaps her own stupidity in picking a bait beast for a mount. She hissed to herself, eyeing the saddle on his back. Even with a running jump, she couldn't make it. But she needed to be in that saddle and airborne, or else the 13 would be broken apart by her grandmother. Abraxos continued to lie in the sun, vain and indulgent as a cat.
Warrior heart indeed.
She eyed the eastern edge, the saddle, the dangling reins. He'd bucked and thrashed the first time they'd shoved the bit into his mouth, but he'd gotten used to it now. At least, enough so that he'd tried to take off the head of only one handler today. The sun was still rising high, but soon it would start its descent, and then she'd be completely and perfectly ruined. Like hell she would be. You had this coming, was all the warning she gave him, before she took a running leap, landing on his haunch and then scrambling, so fast he had barely lifted his head by the time she scuttled across his scaly back and into the saddle. He jerked upright, stiff as a board as she shoved her booted feet into the stirrups and gripped the reins. "We're flying. Now." She dug her heels into his sides. Perhaps the spurs hurt or surprised him, because Abraxos bucked. Bucked and roared. She yanked on the reins as hard as she could.
"Enough,"
she barked, hauling with one arm to guide him over the eastern edge.
"Enough, Abraxos!"
He was still thrashing, and she clenched her thighs as hard as she could to stay in the saddle, leaning into each movement. When the bucking didn't dislodge her, he lifted his wings as if he would fling her off.
"Don't you dare,"
she growled. But he was still twisting and bellowing.
"Stop it!"
Her brain rattled in her skull, and her teeth clacked together so hard she had to retract her fangs so they didn't punch right through her skin. But Abraxos kept bucking, wild and frantic. Not toward the eastern edge, but away, toward the lip of the western plunge.
"Abraxos, stop!"
He was going to go right over, and then they'd splatter on the stones. He was so panicked, so enraged, that her voice was no more than a crackling leaf on the wind. The western drop loomed to her right, then her left, flashing beneath the leathery mottled wings as they flapped and snapped. Under Abraxos's massive talons, stones hissed and crumbled as he neared the edge.
"Abraxos!"
But then his legs slid off the cliff, and Manon's world tilted down, 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 as he lost his grip, and they plummeted into open air. Chapter 32. Manon didn't have time to contemplate her oncoming death. She was too busy holding on to the saddle, the world flipping and spinning, the wind shrieking. Or perhaps that was Abraxos, as they plunged down the cliff face. Her muscles locked and trembled, but she kept her arms laced through the straps, the only thing keeping her from death, even as it swiftly approached with every rotation of Abraxos's ruined body. The trees below took shape, as did the spiked wind-carved rocks between them. Faster and faster, the cliff wall a blur of gray and white. Maybe his body would take the impact and she could walk away. Maybe all those rocks would go right through them both. Maybe he'd flip and she would land on the rocks first. She hoped it would happen too quickly for her to recognize just how she was dying, to know what part of her broke first. They hurtled down. There was a little river running through the spiked rocks. Wind slammed into them from below, a draft that rocked Abraxos upright. But they were still rotating, still plunging.
"Open your wings!"
she screamed over the wind, over her thundering heart. They stayed shut.
"Open them and pull up,"
she bellowed, just as the rapids on the stream began to appear. Just as she understood that she hated the oncoming embrace of the darkness, and that there was nothing to do to stop this splattering, this doom from... She could see the pine cones on the trees.
"Open them!"
A last rallying war cry against the darkness. A war cry that was answered with a piercing shriek as Abraxos flung open his wings, caught the updraft, and sent them soaring away from the ground. Manon's stomach went from her throat right out her ass, but they were swooping upward, and his wings were pumping, each boom the most beautiful sound she had ever heard in her long, miserable life. Higher he flapped, legs tucked beneath him. Manon crouched in her saddle, clinging to his warm hide as he took them up the face of the neighboring mountain. Its peaks rose to meet them like lifted hands, but he wobbled past, beating hard. Manon lifted and fell with him, not taking one breath as they cleared the highest snow-capped peak, and Abraxos, in joy or rage or for the hell of it, gripped clawfuls of snow and ice, and set them scattering behind, the sun lighting them up like a trail of stars. The sun was blinding as they hit the open sky, and there was nothing around them but clouds as massive as the mountains far below, castles and temples of white and purple and blue. And the cry that Abraxos let out as they entered that hall of clouds, as he leveled out and caught a lightning-fast current carving a pathway through it. She had not understood what it had been like for him to live his entire life underground, chained and beaten and crippled. Until then. Until she heard that noise of undiluted, unyielding joy. Until she echoed it, tipping her head back to the clouds around them. They sailed over a sea of clouds, and Abraxos dipped his claws in them before tilting to race up a wind-carved column of cloud, higher and higher, until they reached its peak, and he flung out his wings in the freezing thin sky, stopping the world entirely for a heartbeat. And Manon, because no one was watching, because she did not care, flung out her arms as well and savored the free fall. The wind now a song in her ears, in her shriveled heart. The gray skies were just filling with light as the sun slipped over the horizon at their backs. Bundled in her red cloak, Manon sat atop Abraxos, her vision slightly cloudy from the inner lid she'd already blinked into place. Still, she surveyed her 13, astride their wyverns at the mouth of the canyon run. They'd assembled in two rows of six, Asterin and her pale blue mount directly behind Manon, leading the first row, Sorrel claiming center in the second. They were all awake and alert, and slightly befuddled. Abraxos's damaged wings weren't ready to make the narrow crossing, not yet, so they'd met at the back door, where they'd walked their wyverns the 2 miles to the first canyon run. Walked like a proper unit, in rank and quietly. The mouth of the canyon was wide enough for Abraxos to leap into an easy glide. Takeoffs were a problem thanks to the shredded muscle and weak spots in his wings, areas that had taken too many beatings and might never be at their full strength. But she did not need to explain that to her 13, because it was none of their damn business, and it did not impact them. "Every morning, from today until the war games," Manon said, staring into the labyrinth of ravines and archways that made up the wind-carved canyon. "We will meet here, and until breakfast we are going to train. Then we will have our afternoon training with the other covens. Tell no one." She'd just have to leave early so she could get Abraxos airborne while the others made the crossing. "I want us in close quarters. I don't care what the men say about keeping the mount separate. Let the wyverns sort out their dominance. Let them squabble. But they are going to fly, tight as armor. There will be no gaps and no room for attitude or territorial horseshit. We fly this cannon together, or we don't fly at all." She looked each of the witches and their mounts in the eye. Abraxos, to her surprise, did the same. What he lacked in size, he made up for in sheer will, speed, and dexterity. He sensed currents even before Manon did. "When we are done, if we survive, we'll meet on the other side and do it again. Until it's perfect. Your beasts will learn to trust each other and follow orders." The wind kissed her cheeks. "Don't fall behind," she said. And Abraxos plunged into the canyon. Chapter 33. In the week that followed, there were no more bodies, and certainly no hint of the creature that had drained those people. Though Selena often found herself thinking over the details, as Rowan made her light candle after candle at the ruins of the sun goddess's temple. Now that she could shift on command, This was her new task, to light a candle without destroying everything in sight. She failed every time, singeing her cloak, cracking the ruins, incinerating trees as her magic tore out of her. But Rowan had a bottomless supply of candles, so she spent her days staring at them until her eyes crossed. She could sweat for hours and focus on honing her anger and all that nonsense, but not get as much as a tendril of smoke. The only thing that came of it was an unending appetite. Selena ate whatever and whenever she could, thanks to her magic gobbling so much of her energy. The rain returned, and with it the crowd for Emrys' stories. Selena always listened while she washed the night's dishes, to tales of shield maidens and enchanted animals and cunning sorcerers, all the legends of Wendolyn. Rowan still appeared in his hawk form, and there were some nights when she even sat beside the back door, and Rowan sidled a bit closer too. Selena was standing at the sink, back throbbing and hunger gnawing at her belly, as she scrubbed the last of the copper pots, while Emrys finished narrating the story of a clever wolf and a magical firebird. There was a pause, and then came the usual requests for the same old stories. Selena didn't acknowledge the heads that turned in her direction, as she asked from the sink, "Do you know any stories about Queen Maeve?" Dead silence. Emrys' eyes widened before he smiled faintly and said,
"Lots. Which one would you like to hear?"
"The earliest ones that you know?" "All of them." If she was going to face her aunt again, perhaps she should start learning as much as she could. Emrys might know stories that hadn't reached the shores of her own lands. If the stories about the skinwalkers had been true, if the immortal stags were real, perhaps she could glean something vital here. There were some nervous glances, but at last Emrys said,
"Then I shall start at the beginning."
Selena nodded and moved to sit in her usual chair, propped against the back door next to the sharp-eyed hawk. Rowan clicked his beak, but she didn't dare look over her shoulder at him. Instead, she dug into an entire loaf of bread.
"Long ago, when there was no mortal king on Wendland's throne, the fairies still walked among us. Some were good and fair, some were prone to little mischiefs, and some were fouler and darker than the blackest night. But they were all of them ruled by Maeve and her two sisters, whom they called Mora and Mab. Cunning Mora, who bore the shape of a great hawk." That was Rowan's mighty bloodline. "Fair Mab, who bore the shape of a swan. And the dark Maeve, whose wildness could not be contained by any single form."
Emrys recited the history, much of which Selena knew. Mora and Mab had fallen in love with human men and yielded their immortality. Some said Maeve forced them to give up their gift of eternal life as punishment. Some said they wanted to, if only to escape their sister. And when Selena asked, the room falling deathly silent again, if Maeve herself had ever mated, Emrys told her no, though she had come close, at the dawn of time. A warrior, rumor claimed, had stolen her heart with his clever mind and pure soul. But he had died in some long-ago war, and lost the ring he'd intended for her. And since then, Maeve had cherished her warriors above all others. They loved her for it, made her a mighty queen whom no one dared challenge. Selena expected Rowan to puff his feathers at that, but he remained still and quiet on his perch. Emrys told stories about the Fae Queen well into the night, painting a portrait of a ruthless, cunning ruler who could conquer the world if she wished, but instead kept to her forest realm of Dorinel, planting her stone city in the heart of a massive river basin. Selena picked through the details and committed them to memory, trying not to think about the prince perched a few feet above her, who had willingly sworn a blood oath to the immortal monster who dwelled beyond the mountains. She was about to ask for another story when she caught the motion in the trees. She choked on the piece of blackberry pie she was in the middle of devouring as the massive mountain cat trotted from the forest and across the rain-drenched grass, heading right for their door. The rain had darkened its golden fur, and its eyes gleamed in the torches. Did the guards not see it? Malachi was listening to his mate with rapt attention. She opened her mouth to shout a warning when she paused. The guards saw everything, and weren't shooting, because it wasn't a mountain cat, but... In a flash that could have been distant lightning, the mountain cat became a tall, broad-shouldered male walking toward the open door. Rowan surged into flight, then shifted, seamlessly landing mid-stride as he walked into the rain. The two males clasped forearms and clapped each other on the back, a quick, efficient greeting. With the rain and Emrys's narrating, it was hard to hear, and she silently cursed her mortal ears as she strained to listen.
"I've been looking for you for 6 weeks," the golden-haired stranger said, his voice sharp but hollow.
Not urgent, but tired and frustrated.
"Vaughn said you were at the eastern border, but Lorkin said you were on the coast inspecting the fleet. Then the twins told me that the Queen had been all the way out here with you and returned alone, so I came on a hunch."
He was babbling, his lack of control at odds with his hard muscles and the weapons strapped to him. A warrior, like Rowan, though his surprisingly lovely face had none of the prince's severity. Rowan put a hand on the male's shoulder.
"I heard what happened, Gavriel."
Was this one of Rowan's mysterious friends? She wished Emrys were free to identify him. Rowan had told her so little about his five companions, but it was clear that Rowan and Gavriel were more than acquaintances. She sometimes forgot that Rowan had a life beyond this fortress. It hadn't bothered her before, and she wasn't sure why remembering it now suddenly settled in her stomach like a dead weight, or why it suddenly mattered that Rowan at least acknowledged that she was there, that she existed. Gavriel scrubbed at his face, his heavily muscled back expanding as he took a breath.
"I know you probably don't want to..."
"Just tell me what you want, and it will be done."
Gavriel seemed to deflate, and Rowan guided him toward another door. They both moved with unearthly, powerful grace, as if the rain itself parted to let them through. Rowan didn't even look back at her before he disappeared. Rowan didn't come back for the rest of the night, and curiosity, not kindness, made her realize his friend probably hadn't had dinner. At least, no one had brought anything out of the kitchen, and Rowan hadn't called for food. So why not bring up a tray of stew and bread? Balancing the heavy tray on her hip, she knocked on his door. The murmuring within went silent, and for a second, she had the mortifying thought that perhaps the male was here for a far more intimate reason. Then someone snapped,
"What?"
And she eased open the door wide enough to glance in.
"I thought you might want some stew and..."
Well, the stranger was half-naked, and lying on his back atop Rowan's work table. But Rowan was fully clothed, seated before him, and looking pissed as hell. Yes. She had certainly walked in on something private. It took a heartbeat to note the flattened needles, the small cauldron-shaped vat of dark pigment, the rag soaked with ink and blood, and the tracings of a tattoo snaking from the stranger's left pectoral down his ribs and right to his hip bone.
"Get out,"
Rowan said flatly, lowering the needle. Gavriel lifted his head, the bright candles showing tawny eyes glazed with pain, and not necessarily from the markings being etched over his heart and ribcage. Words in the old language, just like Rowan's. There were already so many, most of them aged and interrupted by various scars.
"Do you want the stew?" she asked,
still staring at the tattoo, the blood, the little iron pot of ink. And the way Rowan seemed as much at ease with the tools in his hands as he did with his weapons. Had he made his own tattoo?
"Leave it,"
he said. And she knew, just knew, that he would bite her head off later. Schooling her features into neutrality, she set the tray on the bed and walked back to the door. "Sorry to interrupt." Whatever the tattoos were for, however they knew each other, she had no right to be in here. The pain in the stranger's eyes told her enough. She'd seen it in her own reflection plenty. Gavriel's attention darted between her and Rowan, his nostrils flaring. He was smelling her. It was definitely time to get the hell out.
"Sorry,"
she said again, and shut the door behind her. She made it 2 steps down the hall before she had to stop and lean against the stone wall, rubbing at her face. Stupid. Stupid to even care what he did outside of training. To think he might consider sharing personal information with her. Even if it was only that he was retiring to his rooms early. It hurt, though. More than she wanted to admit. She was about to drag herself to her room when the door flung open down the hall, and Rowan stormed out, practically glowing with ire. But just seeing the lividness written all over him had her riding that reckless, stupid edge again, and clinging to the anger was easier than embracing the quiet darkness that wanted to pull her down, down, down. Before he could start shouting, she asked, "Do you do it for money?" A flicker of teeth.
"One, it's none of your business. And 2, I would never stoop so low."
The look he gave her told her exactly what he thought of her profession. "You know, it might be better if you just slapped me instead."
"Instead of what?"
"Instead of reminding me again and again how rutting, worthless, and awful and cowardly I am. Believe me, I can do the job well enough on my own. So just hit me, because I'm damned tired of trading insults. And you know what? You didn't even bother to tell me you'd become unavailable. If you'd said something, I never would have come. I'm sorry I did, but you just left me downstairs." Saying those last words made a sharp, quick panic rise up in her. An aching pain that had her throat closing. "You left me," she repeated. Maybe it was only out of blind terror at the abyss opening up again around her. But she whispered,
"I have no one left. No one."
She hadn't realized how much she meant it. How much she needed it not to be true. Until now. His features remained impassive, turning vicious even, as he said,
"There is nothing that I can give you. Nothing I want to give you. You are not owed an explanation for what I do outside of training. I don't care what you have been through or what you want to do with your life. The sooner you can sort out your whining and self-pity, the sooner I can be rid of you. You are nothing to me, and I do not care."
There was a faint ringing in her ears that turned into a roar. And beneath it, a sudden wave of numbness. A too familiar lack of sight or sound or feeling. She didn't know why it happened, because she had been so dead set on hating him. But it would have been nice, she supposed. It would have been nice to have one person who knew the absolute truth about her and didn't hate her for it. It would have been really, really nice. She walked away without another word. With each step she took back to her room, that flickering light inside of her guttered and went out. Chapter 34. Selena did not remember curling up in her bed, boots still on. She did not remember her dreams, or feel the pangs of hunger or thirst when she awoke. and she could barely respond to anyone as she trudged down to the kitchen and set about helping with breakfast. Everything swirled past in dull colors and whispered.